But, you know, really, the very best of luck to you. And we'll certainly be following you along the way and cheering you on. Hopefully we'll hear from you again, you know, if not before you go, then definitely we want you back in the studio when you've finished.
Brilliant.
Now I'm afraid it's time for the top of the hour.
You don't know the number one radio station in Bristol and its own class. This is where you need to be. Ujima 98 FM. Pop! Pop!
Here are the ingredients. A little new school.
Oh, na, na. What's the name?
A little.
Everybody say. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Some soul.
Cause tonight is the night that I'm feeling alright.
A little. A little R&B.
They know, they know, they know. They know, they know, they know.
And a taste of old school.
Tell your brother, your sister, and your mama too.
It's a pleasure when you treasure all that's new and true and gay.
The heart of Bristol.
Keep on moving.
You're listening to Ujima 98 FM.
And welcome back. It's just gone 1 o'clock on Wednesday the 14th of August, and it's a lighter look at Lifetime. Judeline here, so welcome to everybody. And I'm joined by my usual little panel, a selection of panels, Stephanie, Jackie and Cheryl. And our topic for today is language, but particularly looking at proverbs and axioms. Because apparently there was some concern and research done that proverbs aren't being used as much as possible. And one says, what's a proverb? So I'm looking to one of our authors, Stephanie, to define what a proverb is. Please.
Oh, on the spot, am I? It's one of these things that was drummed into me probably 40 years ago. And I've since I think of a proverb as... a little saying, axiomatic in some senses, but that incorporates a lesson or a believed lesson about life, something that we think is and repeat. So, you know, an apple a day keeps the doctor away is probably one of the things that I might think of as possibly a proverb, or many hands make light work, or too many cooks spoil the broth. Now, whether those are absolutely true or not, they were certainly believed as little repeatable lessons at some point, and we think of them as proverbs now.
I suppose something that often the first I recall hearing, and again my memory has to stretch back a few decades, is something that parents or teachers offered you, and I suppose there's a element of truth in the statement. But shall I ask you, or who's going to offer what they think, I believe, an axiom to be?
Yeah.
English language lesson number
English
one.
English language lessons, yes. An axiom is more like something you would get in a scientific proof, where it's a statement of this. This is an obvious truth.
Ah.
So, you know, the straight lines have two ends, or something like that, or 2 + 2 = 4. So that will be an axiom that you would start a mathematical or scientific argument from, whereas a proverb, the dictionary definition that I've got here says a short popular saying, usually of unknown and ancient origin, that expresses some commonplace truth, or at least something that is thought to be true, but isn't something that is necessarily obviously true and something that you might quibble with in some way.
Yes, why I raised it was there was an article in the Metro, I think 2 or 3 days ago, in a fairly lengthy article about usage of proverbs. And from my recollection, some have a biblical root, some possibly, given England's maritime history, military, naval background or root.
And
I'm trying to think... Any port in a storm, yes.
Some of them obviously have agricultural roots.
Yes,
like April showers bring forth May flowers.
Where, right, I mean, and red sky at night.
Exactly.
But do you think that people don't use them as often? I mean, we were talking earlier about how we had grammar drummed into our English language lessons. I don't know if it's as commonplace today, or whether grammar seems to, I mean, for all I've read quite recently, spelling doesn't seem to matter. Whereas, you know, I shrink. I mean, I often did copywriting. When you're looking through the typos in newspapers, for example.
But yes. If you're a child at school, you have to do loads of spelling tests. My children are always doing spelling tests. They have the 50 club, the 100 club, where they have to do 100 spellings all at once.
I disaggregated a bit, although the cause may have the same root. I mean, you know, the rules of grammar, the rules of spelling are sort of drummed in. I suppose once you leave school, there's no one there to put a big red X across your papers if you get it wrong. But I don't, certainly proverbs and axioms are being used a lot less than when I was a child. And I sort of welcome that, because what I seem to remember is older folks constantly parroting the same endless phrases, which I found pretty meaningless and frankly quite often pretty boring. And I think to some extent there's a historical value to them, and there may be a bit of regret about losing that, but I quite like the fact that people are being so creative with language and are finding new ways of expressing whatever it is they want to say, instead of regurgitating the same phrases that have been regurgitated at them for the last 300 years.
That's those, as I say, language changes, so language usage now reflects, doesn't it, the technology of today wasn't around, say, in those old biblical days or pre, you know, global media, etc.
There's a Lily Allen song, isn't there? I can't remember what the title is, and we probably can't quote anything from it because it will be full of words that we're not allowed to say on the radio. But basically, it was from the point of view of a teenage girl who's getting incredibly irritated with her elder relatives for keeping coming out with these proverbs that she finds quite meaningless. And, you know, it just goes from that point of view that these are old people's sayings that are no longer relevant in the world.
Yes, I think one of the first I remember, my mother was saying, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. So there are echoes of parental...
I think that's the kind of saying I remember and have always taken great exception to, because I'm all about acquiring as much knowledge as possible. So I think part of that is that sense of irrelevance. But the other thing that occurs to me, especially in such a multicultural society as Britain is as there are more people with different language traditions to whom these very British axioms and proverbs have no particular historical meaning, and that's who we're communicating with as children in school, as adults growing up, there's less perhaps of the sort of shared historical and cultural basis to continually trot out these very old axioms and proverbs. And you know, one can regret that or welcome it. Personally, I welcome it. But I think it means we come up with new ways of saying things that are broader and more global.
But don't you think that proverbs and axioms are particularly come into their own in families and colloquial sort of settings? Like, I can remember my mum saying, up and down like a Western donkey. And that's got to be a Bristol saying, do you know what I mean?
For the benefit of our listeners around the world, that's Weston, Weston, not Western. And it refers to the donkeys that you ride on at the seaside at Western Supermare.
And I suppose that's from the difficulty, because I remember people saying that often in, you know, for people from the West Indies, where they were taking exams that were based on English daily practice and culture, that often that would be very difficult, and, you know, would often stymie them in terms of being on an equal footing, you know, for the exam purpose, because they hadn't lived during an English winter or didn't often grasp some of those more, as Jackie's just said, the more colloquial sayings. But I've just finished reading Erica Jong, and I found some of the Jewish both proverbs that grandmother and great-grandmother trotted out. The one that I liked was, kindness is the highest wisdom. I mean, some of them do have a poignancy about them.
I'd be very happy if that one caught on.
Yeah. Yes. And any others? I mean, I was about to ask, having just read that, whether, you know, proverbs can't be just the domain of English language speakers. I mean, as I've just said, the old wisdoms that are handed down in, you know, Jewish. And I do quite like the humour in some of them, or the cutting humour in them. Like one behind can't ride two horses or something.
Mm. I think every language develops their own. There's certainly quite a lot in Jamaica. Of course, my head's gone completely blank, and it would be in Patois anyway, which, mind you, a lot of the listenership might understand. But I think it is something that every language develops their own sayings, but they're unique to that language and that cultural and historical experience. So, you know, they work, as you say, within households, within families, where that's a shared experience. But once you start to, you know, interact with people who don't have that shared family or cultural or historical experience, it becomes quite meaningless. I mean, I quite like the line about the donkey, but I'm not sure I understand it.
I think she was saying, you know, if she had to do too many things too often, like get up and make it, like someone asked her to do too many things, like get up and make a cup of tea too often or something, it would be up and down like a Western donkey. Yeah.
Right.
Because the donkeys go up and down, like, right, like Cheryl explained.
Yeah, because that must be quite the baffling point, mustn't it? That you're using something that's literal, i.e. the donkeys going up and down the beach, to apply to maybe a boring or, you know, mundane tasks like, you know, housework or, say, or what's expected of you. I mean, you don't expect donkeys to go off track, do you? Take the odd swim or something.
Where would something like Queen Anne's Dead come in? Pardon? Dancing? where would a saying, would that be an axiom or a proverb, or would that just be a saying? Queen Anne's Dead. That's something else my mum used to say.
I don't know.
Never heard that one.
In the context of, let me explain the context. The context would be, you say a piece of information and it is old news. So then my mother would say, Queen Anne's dead, like, that's an old piece of information. I know that that's an old piece of information. I'm not quite sure if it's a proverb, more like a just a saying, I think.
So maybe what makes it even more difficult to comprehend then is often how, if you like, sarcasm's used in some languages or cultures more than others. I presume that was a sarcastic
comment. Yeah, it's a very sarcastic comment, yes. So once you actually know what it means, and now I do, and I might use that. But yeah, I mean, all of these things tend to have some sort of cultural context. Irony, for example, our American friends are often accused of being completely unable to get irony. But now they've discovered hipsters, and perhaps they're getting better at it.
Irony. No, you see, sometimes I do lose it, because I have to check the dictionary about irony and parodies and satire, because sometimes they tend to overlap or blend. But do you find, Stephanie, that as a writer, you maybe think of a traditional saying and then try and recreate it? Or doesn't it come into your writer head?
That's an interesting question, given what I write. And sort of, yes, I write science fiction, but fairly near future. Set around 150 years in the future, and language, the way my characters communicate with each other is a very major part of the texture of the books. There's a character in particular who is very fond of creating axioms, creating sort of witty sayings that tie his listeners into knots. And so because he's very clever, and he's frequently cleverer than me, when I need to think of something clever for him to say, it can take me quite some time, because you can't rely on something that would be a current phrase now. But it's also, I tend to think back, what, you know, in terms of names as well as sayings, as well as the way people use language. And you try to shift it forward, but your readership is modern, so it can't be go too wild or no one will understand. But then I think, you know, we still speak recognizably the same way that our forebears did 150 years ago. So it's not too far-fetched. It's about thinking, if you look at what the progression has been over the last 150 years in terms of colloquialisms and language and the way people express themselves, and you try to project that forward at roughly the same rate, what do you end up with? You end up with people who speak pretty much the way we do, but will have invented new twists of phrase and ways of using language to make their point. So in my next novel, which is out next year, he's having a slightly fraught conversation with a bishop, which he needs to end as politely as possible. And I have him say, if my editor doesn't make me change this phrase, that the impact of religion is always appreciated, if not always appreciable, which was the politest put down I could come up with for him to say in the context of the conversation. And that's probably the kind of thing you're talking about, which might become axiomatic in 150 years' time. I don't know.
Yes, I guess maybe with modern language, people's maybe attention span getting shorter, that the axioms or ways of communicating orally are far more direct, that we don't maybe have the luxury, or if you choose to look at it that way, of elongated language or discussion.
Well, it's certainly not in the age of Twitter. I've just been on Twitter in the break talking about the earlier segment that we were on together, Cheryl and I, and there is no space for long pithy sayings. In 140 characters, especially when you're trying to link to people. Nor is there. I do try, but it can be quite challenging. And I think that's becoming... We communicate more because of the internet, because of social media. We have so many more platforms and avenues, but we spend less time on each of them. Absolutely. And that is changing the way we use language.
Well, thank you, my three panel members. And we're going to have a short break now for the ads, and then we have Stephanie again.
This is Johnny Bling from Dancehall Generals.
I am Miss P alongside
Deeper from the Ninja Mix crew.
On Thursday, 15th of August,
we will be taking part in the next Rumble.
On the radio.
To see who will be victorious in the next encounter.
Music categories: dancehall, hip hop,
soccer,
R&B,
Afrobeats.
Doors open 9:30 till 8. Admission is free.
So come out and support your team. Niger Crew versus
Dancehall Generals
at the Bank 84 Stokescroft.
Who will be victorious?
You decide. On Thursday, 15th of August.
Are you ready for a challenge? A challenge for work and training at the same time. Apprenticeships aren't for the faint-hearted. They're for determined young people who are ready to kickstart their career. Listen in and find out more with Junior Saunders every Monday at 6 p.m. to 7 p.m.
Looking for a lively, light and creative space to teach, rehearse or hold a functional indoor event? Then you've been looking for In Alignment Studios. Based on the fourth floor Hamilton House, Stokescroft, above the canteen, this spacious studio is equipped to take care of your movement and dance needs. Home to DMAC UK, the company that gives you street dance, belly dance, African dance and drumming, Zumba, Capoeira, Five Rhythms, Pilates, Pilates and many more great moves for your hearties. There's so much packed into our studios, you'll find something to get you moving. For studio hire or class listings, visit our website, www.dmacuk.org, like us on Facebook, pop into Hamilton House BS13QY, or call us on 0717 9249599. DMAC UK, dedicated to the reconstruction and maintenance of your vibrational makeup.
Yeah, this is Levi Ruth, Dragon Slayer, and you're listening to the One Love Breakfast. Respect you.
Wake up to the One Love Breakfast every weekday morning from 7 a.m. on Ujima 98 and BCFM 93.2. Keeping Bristol together. Come and join the thousands of people who care about our city and the diverse communities that make it up. Wake up to the One Love Breakfast, Bristol's only local breakfast show that celebrates diversity. The One Love Breakfast, every weekday from 7 on Ujima 98 and BCFM 93.2.
You've been so good to me. Give you everything.
And welcome back, everybody. This is Women's Outlook, and this is Cheryl Morgan again. It's time for our Woman of the Week segment, and I'm delighted to say that Stephanie Salter has joined us once again. We're going to talk a little bit about her life in Jamaica and in the UK. Just before we start, I want to give you a reminder that our Immigration Advice Service will be running again this afternoon between 3:30 and 5. So if anybody has any questions for the Avon and Bristol Law Centre, do please drop into the UGMA studios in Wilder Street. Now, Stephanie, welcome. Woman of the Week. Congratulations.
I'm very flattered. Thank you.
So, yeah, let's leave all of the science fiction and the book writing aside for now and talk a little bit about you. I gather you come from quite a large Jamaican family.
I come from quite a large Jamaican family, although I'm not typically Jamaican in that sense. I'm the eldest of 8 children, so I've got 7 siblings. I'm in my mid-40s. The youngest is in his late 20s at the moment. So, yeah. 3 right. sisters, 4 brothers.
And are they all as famous as you? I know your brother Storm is like a huge star.
Well, I don't think I'm famous, but no. We've had an interesting few years, my family and I. My 2 youngest brothers, Storm, Soldiers 1, are both filmmakers, and Storm has been getting a lot of attention and acclaim for his film Better Must Come over the last couple of years. He's just been at a film festival in Amsterdam. He is one of the leaders of a new movement in Caribbean cinema. So yes, he's probably the most famous of us at the moment. My youngest brother, Niall, is also a filmmaker, and he does music videos and commercials. And one of my other brothers, Astro, is a digital artist, and he's had a wonderful year. He's had his first solo show, which was very well received. He was in the Jamaica National Gallery's biennial, and he and Niall are both among 10 emerging artists in the National Gallery's current New Roots exhibition in Kingston. So, they're doing incredibly well. I'm really proud of them.
That's certainly quite a family. So, but let's bring it back to you now. Why did you choose to come to the UK to live?
I get asked this all the time, and I don't have a particularly profound answer. I've been living in Miami for over 10 years, and I desperately needed a change, and it felt like I needed more than a professional change, a change of location. And London popped into my head as the place that I wanted to be. And I tend to, once I've decided what it is I want to do, I tend to just then work out how to do it. So I worked out how to do it. At the time, it was the immigration requirements were the highly skilled migrant program, which I qualified for. And I did it, but I didn't come because of a job or because of a relationship or because of any of the typical things people would cite. I came because I decided that I wanted to live in London for a while.
So you are a highly skilled migrant. What is it that you do?
At the moment, I'm mostly a writer, which we're not going to talk about at the moment. Yeah, but I had had a long career in startups, in business development, mostly in the hospitality industry, a bit in the entertainment industry at that time. And there was it's a sort of a list of qualifications if you have the right educational degree and career progression and so on and so forth. You simply qualify under those settings. Once I got to the UK, I spent the next several years working in project management, mostly in areas in need of regeneration. And that has sort of also bridged over into public policy development, working either with directly with local and national government departments to develop new programs around mostly around regeneration and affordable housing, or sometimes working with the private sector in their interactions with local and national government.
So did you have anything to do with this sort of area while you were doing that? Any projects around Bristol worked on?
No, I've never done any work in Bristol. My first job was as a project manager with a firm in London who were advising on a number of regeneration areas. This was way back in the early 2000s, in a number of areas of the UK, none of which was Bristol. And then I worked quite solidly for a few years in East London, in the Shoreditch area, as part of the then government's New Deal for Communities programme, which was a really intensive 10-year project to pump quite a lot of money and, more importantly, expertise into some of the most deprived areas in the UK. And that Shoreditch area in Hackney was one of them. So I worked there in housing regeneration for several years, and then from that went into management consulting and worked with a number of clients.
Well, that must be very satisfying if you're actually seeing the area regenerate as a result of the work you're doing.
It is absolutely wonderfully satisfying. I am actually in the process of moving. I've been out of London for a few years. I'm about to move back, and I'm moving into the area that I was working in back then from 2006, I think it was, to 2008, which is not an area at the time I would have wished to live in. And I'm delighted to say that it's now, you know, a wonderful place to live. So to some, whatever small part the work we did played in that is immensely gratifying.
So you said you're moving back to London now. I know that you are living in North Devon. How did you end up there?
Again, it was probably not dissimilar to the process that led me to London in the first place. I was a bit burnt out. I'd been working very hard in the city. I was feeling a bit dissatisfied with life. I didn't want to leave this country, which I love, but I sort of felt as though I'd needed a bit of a break from that intensive city life, needed to move back to the country. I grew up in the countryside in Jamaica, and it just felt as though I needed to be surrounded by green instead of concrete for a while. And I'd found very early in my living in the UK that was the area I kept going back to on long weekends to get out of the city. So I basically made the decision to go freelance and live in the country.
What about the sea? Because you were born on an island. Did you miss living next to the sea?
I missed it up to a point. And that's one of the attractions of North Devon, is that it is close to the beach. But of course, the beach in England isn't quite like the beach in Jamaica.
No.
So my experience of the seaside in Jamaica, which is basically wandering around in a bikini all day, doesn't really work even on the beautiful beaches of North Devon. But yes, I think I miss that sense of space, actually, of sort of big skies and big landscapes and vistas and birds singing outside your window in the morning.
Have you ever been out to the Isles of Scilly?
I haven't.
I can recommend that. Obviously, it's not as warm as Jamaica, and you don't get the exotic birds and things, but it gives you some idea of island life, I think.
Yeah, it's on the list.
Okay. So I said we weren't going to talk about your books, but there is something else very interesting that you've done, and that's this thing called Scriptopus. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, well, if I hadn't done Scriptopus, I'm not sure I would have become a writer. And I think it grew out of starting to want to write, but like many other writers, finding it very difficult to find the time to work out what to write about, to get myself into the discipline of it. So Scriptopus is an idea I came up with in 2009 and launched as a website in early 2010. And it is an interactive web application where you basically go onto the site, scriptopus.com, and you will see a paragraph of a story. And if you don't like what you see, you can scroll through until you find one you do like. But essentially, your task is in 15 minutes and 1,000 characters to write the next segment of the story. And so you have no responsibility for what came before, what's going to come after. You just have to sort of do the next bit. A certain amount of interaction has been built into it, in that every time a new segment is added, everyone who's contributed up to that point gets an email that points them back towards it. So a group of friends could actually sort of play online and do a story segment that way. But I kind of wanted it to be a way of giving would-be writers, as I was myself at the time, a really simple way of doing a daily creative writing exercise in a short space of time. And as I said, without the pressure of trying to work out what to write about.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like a great creative writing course idea that just gives you plenty of practice at coming up with what happens next.
Yes, that was exactly the point of it. But of course, in order to launch it, I had to come up with a lot of content. So I would have could start a lot of these stories off. So I actually ended up doing a huge amount of writing of random bits of the beginnings of possible stories, and of course recruiting friends and family to do the same. And interestingly, although it's worked very well once it was launched, it probably, the process of getting it launched probably did for me what I needed. And I have actually often thought that had I not done the exercise of conceiving and launching Scriptopus, I would not have gotten it together to write an actual novel.
Alrighty. Finally, just before we go to the news, you know, I know back in Jamaica that there's a big music scene and whatever, and I gather your family knows Chris Blackwell, one of the founders of Island Records.
Chris's family, sort of. We know Chris very well. I worked for him for many years. One of my sisters is actually his partner and the mother of his youngest son, Chance. So he is sort of family. But he was, long before any of that happened, he was my boss for many, many years. And his interests are much wider than music. He's also, you know, worked founded hotel companies and done other things. But yes, my background in the entertainment industry, such as it is, was working for Chris in the 90s in his film and music divisions in Jamaica and Los Angeles. And he's a great guy, wonderful man. I'm very, very fond of him.
So I have to ask you, have you ever met Brian Eno?
Not really. He's been at parties that I've been at along with 500 other people.
Never mind. Okay, well, thank you ever so much for joining us, Stephanie. It's been an absolutely fascinating glimpse into your life. We're going to come up to the news now, and after that, we're going to talk about summer reading, and Stephanie has kindly volunteered to join us and give her recommendations. See you soon, folks.
Keeping Bristol informed. Ujima News, brought to you by BBC Radio Bristol.
The Conservatives and Liberal Democrats have decided to give their share of £500,000 bequest from a Bristol woman to the Treasury after a row about how she'd intended the money to be spent. Joan Edwards, a former nurse who died last September at the age of 90, left the money in her will to whichever government is in office at the date of my death, but her executors shared it between the two political parties. Patrick O'Neill is from a will-writing service in Bristol. He says it's vital to make the wording specific.
I've been asked to draft the provisions. I'd first of all be asking the individual more detailed questions as to exactly what their intentions were and what they wanted the money used for. Essentially, if it's to be used for the general public goods by way of bolstering taxes, then it should be gifted to the Crown.
Unemployment fell by 4,000 between April and June. It stands at just over 2.5 million. The number of people claiming Job Seekers Allowance fell last month to its lowest level for more than 4 years. David Freeman is from the Office for National Statistics and explains the figures.
Unemployment remains fairly flat, and in the 3 months to June, the number of people unemployed fell by just 4,000, stay at 2.51 million. And the unemployment rate was also stable at 7.8%. We're also releasing the claimant counts, the number of Job Seekers Allowance claimants in July, and they fell by just over 29,000 to 1.4 million claimants. And that's the lowest number of claimants we've seen since the beginning of 2009.
A Bristol sports coach says police failed to properly investigate serious abuse about him, which appeared on a social media site. James says someone set up a Facebook page accusing him of being a child abuser, but that person hasn't been caught. Avon and Somerset police say they take reports of anyone sending malicious communications very seriously. Last year, 20 people from this region were prosecuted. Dr. Claire Hardacre is a linguistics lecturer who studied so-called trolling. She says it's not only police who need to take an interest.
We are very behindhand, I have to say. When it comes to dealing with it, I think we have a lot of things that we need to be doing. For kids right from school, I think we need to be training them on how to be safe online from trolls, but also how to be kind to each other, because some of these children, sadly, will be the bullies of the future. I think we need to be training parents on the signs to recognise. I think we also need to be getting on the police's case a little bit and saying, take this stuff seriously.
The Olympic champion Greg Rutherford is out of the World Athletics Championships after failing to qualify for the long jump final. He was unable to reach the qualifying distance with any of his three jumps. From Moscow, here's the BBC's Mike Costello.
He missed out by just 2 centimetres. Such are the margins between success and failure at this level of international athletics. Rutherford's best effort was 7 metres, 87 centimetres, almost half a metre adrift of his gold medal winning distance at London 2012. It was good enough only for 14th place, with the top 12 qualifying for the final. A hamstring injury suffered 5 weeks ago had threatened his participation, and he came here with hope more than conviction that he could rediscover his best form. There will be questions now as to whether British athletics should have selected an athlete in such circumstances, but for Rutherford himself, the gaze will turn now to a busy 2014 with the World Indoor Championships, the Commonwealth Games and the European Championships.
And in football, the England manager Roy Hodgson says the friendly with Scotland tonight will act as useful preparation ahead of the remaining World Cup qualifiers. The match is the first meeting between the two countries in 14 years.
Ujima News, brought to you by BBC Radio Bristol.
And welcome back, everybody. This is the Women's Outlook show on Ujima Radio, and this is Cheryl Morgan, and we have a bonus book segment for you today. It's that time of year when everybody is heading off to the beach and looking for some light reading to take along with them, so we thought we'd get a panel together and do some recommendations. But first of all, because it's kind of nice to get the kids to read as well, Jackie's sons have put together a little thing about what they're reading. So can you play that, please, Mark?
Hi, my name's Daniel, and I'm here to ask Gideon about what type of books he reads. So, Gideon.
Hi.
So, what types of books do you read?
Tom Keats.
Why do you like this type of book?
Because it's adventurous to read.
So, do you like adventure books and stuff?
Yes.
How old are you?
10.
How many books do you read a week?
At least 3.
Have you read any Harry Potter books? Or
yes.
What books?
Philosopher's Stone.
Say that again.
Philosopher's. Philosopher's Stone.
Okay.
Philosopher. Have you seen any Harry Potter films?
No.
Thank you.
All right. For your...
Thanks for your time.
Hello, my name's Gideon, and I'm here to ask Daniel about what books he reads.
Hello.
What type of books do you like to read?
I like to read, like, adventure books and stuff. 'Cause, yeah.
Why do you like to read adventure books?
Because it's, like, suspenseful and keeps you on the edge of your seat.
Have you read any Harry Potter books?
Yes, I've read a couple.
Have you watched any Harry Potter films?
Yeah, a couple.
Which ones?
I've read the first 3, Philosopher's Stone, Chamber of Secrets.
The Philosopher's Stone.
Chamber of Secrets. And I forgot the 3rd. And, yeah.
How old are you?
12. How much books do you read in a week?
Yeah, couple.
Would you explain Harry Potter as an adventure book?
It's sort of an action adventure, it was like, I don't know, really. Okay.
What is your favourite book?
I don't know, really. It's more of a series of Hunger Games series.
Have you read all the Hunger Games books?
I've read 2 of them.
Thank you for your time.
Bye.
Oh dear, well, well done, kids. It warms the cockles of my fantasy and science fiction reading heart to know that kids are busy reading things like the Harry Potter series and the Hunger Games series. This is all good. We're bringing up a new generation of science fiction and fantasy readers. So the kids were all talking about adventure books, things that are gripping and exciting and whatever. So I just wondered whether any of our panel had any particularly adventurous books that they were planning to read. Stephanie?
I'm actually reading something that I suspect those kids would really, really like. I tend not to do too much light beach reading, but I do like a lot of what are now called young adult novels or children's books if they're well written. And when I was in Jamaica, I came back with a few books. Two are very grown up, but one was a loan from my then 12-year-old nephew who said, Auntie Steph, this is my favorite book and I really want you to read it. It's The Red Pyramid by Rick Riordan, author of the Percy Jackson books. It's probably not normally my thing, but I absolutely understand why he likes it. The British Museum got blown up in Chapter 2, and it's just getting more adventurous from there. And it's interesting, I think, that kids, that young people who read are increasingly interested in books targeted at them, but that have fantasy and science fictional elements. I'm going to recommend, well, I've got a lot of books I could recommend, but I want to recommend a couple of others for young readers. One is Tom Pollock's The City's Son, which came out last year, which is has teenage protagonists. It's set in London. It's absolutely brilliant. And one of my recent purchases is a sequel to that, The Glass Republic, which I'm really looking forward to starting. And the other was a great read from earlier this year called Planes Runner by Ian MacDonald, who is much better known, I think, as a writer of very grown up and quite intense science fiction, but he's written a fabulous book with a teenage protagonist who largely there are strong elements of Bristol in it, so there's got lots and lots of local interest, but it's got lots of adventure and lots of jumping between worlds and lots of incredibly fun and sometimes explosive things happening with a protagonist who is interesting and unusual in that he is both very, very smart and completely unembarrassed by it. He's a great football player, and he is an Asian kid from Tottenham.
And it has Captain Anastasia Sixsmith from Bristol, who
she
is
certainly does, and she is fantastic. I'd crew on her ship anytime.
Absolutely, yes. Jackie, you got any adventurous stories you've been reading?
Well, this is an adventure of a reality nature in well, I find it very exciting. Usain Bolt, My Story, 9.58. I think that's the fastest time he's run the 100 metres, probably. Although recently he did it in 9.77. So whether he's getting slower, hopefully not. It's called Usain Bolt, My Story, and it's basically about where he comes from, the parish of Trelawney in Jamaica, where they harvest the best yams in the world, apparently. And it says it's about growing up playing cricket and football in the warm Jamaican sun, discovering that he could run fast, very fast. And it's about his family, his friends, and the laid-back Jamaican culture. And basically, it's nice to see Usain Bolt in his context of his family life and what's inspired him, and basically what makes the man that can run the fastest in the world tick.
Wonderful. That sounds very exciting, yes. Especially the cricket. Judeline, how about you? You got an adventurous book?
An adventure, I suppose, I guess, in terms of people's life history. Erica Jong, Blessed Memory. Beginning with the great-grandmother. It spans four generations of Jewish women. And great-grandmother Sarah originates from Russia, a Russian Jew, who, following a pogrom, manages to make her way to America. So touching on her experiences in late 19th century America, New York, and then going on to her relationships, her painting, how she has to hide the fact that she's a woman who can paint, and the deals that she strikes, on then to her daughter Salome, but quite interesting in terms of how bits of their stories reflect women's adventures or non-adventures, and their struggles. But what I liked about it at the end, as the great-granddaughter decides, she's asked to do some curating and putting on an exhibition called Dancing to America. And throughout the book is constant reference to pogroms, the Nazis, and, if you like, the Jewish experience. And she decides to maybe turn it on its head, that often people only understanding of Jewish people's history isn't their art. You know, name a few artists, for example, or sculptors or architects. It's often just in reference to the Holocaust. And she decides to actually have an exhibition of hope and not that pessimism and kind of looking backwards. So an exciting and revelation.
Yeah, that certainly sounds like a very interesting thing. And certainly there's far more to the Jewish people than just the Holocaust.
Yes.
Okay, well, we'll be talking more about summer reading, beach reading later in the programme. But right now, it's time for the ads.
Aces High and Foxy Promotion presents
a bank holiday special, the 24th of August
at the Black Swan, Stapleton Road, Eastville.
Featuring Nike and Nitro, the party specialist,
Rhythm Rider, Passion Radio Bristol,
and Tony V from Ujima Radio.
A night of reggae,
soul,
R&B,
and rare groove.
Admission £5 all night.
Dress code smart, casual,
10 till very late.
Be there.
Be there. Be there.
Just tell you about a gig. Harvey's Wine Bar, Wine Cellars in Denmark Street, Bristol. This, of course, silly of me. And 8 till 8. We'd love you all to come down and join us. We have a fantastic live band.
Anyway, so John and Richard, we appear live, but it's the Harvey's Bristol Blues, first Tuesday of every month at Harvey's Cellars, 12 Denmark Street, Bristol. But we'd love to see you there. In the meantime, here is...
Make sure this Bank Holiday Monday, the 26th of August, is a fun-filled party for you, your family and your friends. Join Signpost, Right Direction, Bristol, West Indies and Phoenix Cricket Club, alongside a host of others, for the annual Family Fun Day at Rose Green Sports Centre. Infused with the spirit of the Caribbean, there'll be music, food, stalls, sport and a heap of entertainment to keep you in the carnival mood. The fun begins at midday until 8 p.m. and a donation of just £4 per family will be greatly appreciated. That's the 6th annual Family Fun Day at Rose Green Sports Centre. This Bank Holiday Monday, the 26th of August from midday. This event is supported by Bristol's community radio stations Ujima 98 and BTFM 93.2 under the One Love banner.
Welcome back, everybody. Coming into the last segment of Women's Outlook now, this is Cheryl Morgan, and I've got my own beach reading recommendation for you. This is a book called Sister Mine by Nalo Hopkinson. Now, Nalo is Jamaican, although she's lived in Trinidad and Canada and is now lecturing at a university in California. She's had a large number of books out, won lots of awards for them, and Sister Mine is her latest book. It's about two sisters who were born conjoined twins, and they were separated soon after birth. But their father is a demigod, and one of the twins, Abby, has inherited all of his magical powers and is also a brilliant singer and all sorts of things. And the other girl, Makeda, is just an ordinary human girl. And the girls are now teenagers, maybe early 20s, and Makeda is finding it very hard to live with this sister who has all these magical powers and is in with all her divine family and whatever, when poor Makeda is just an ordinary human. So she decides she's going to leave home, get her own place and make her own way in the ordinary human world. I just want to read you a little bit about where she's going house hunting. She's trying to find somewhere really cheap in Toronto where she can get somewhere to stay. And she talks about this place that she's looking at. The exterior paint job was something else, in a wacky way that I liked. Probably, years before, someone had slopped teal green paint onto the raw brick. They'd used a dark, muddy purple for the exterior window rims and sills and the edging around the roof. Then, for good measure, they'd lined the inner surfaces of the windows' rims with dark yellow, kind of a mango colour. Made the windows look like the insides of baby birds' beaks when they gaped them wide and demanded food from their exhausted parents. I thought that was a lovely little piece of description there. But Nalo is a fabulous writer, so if you see any of her books, do get hold of them. Now, something else that I wanted to mention. Last night, the shortlists for something called the World Fantasy Awards were announced. It's something that Stephanie and I are fairly familiar with because this is one of the major awards in our field. So again, there's a few books that are worth reading here. I just want to go down the novel shortlist. First book is The Killing Moon by Nora Jemison, who's an African-American writer. This, I think, is a very well thought of. It's a fantasy story essentially about a religion where part of the religion involves giving up your life as when it's time for you to do so. So the priests actually come in and kill people, which is an interesting idea, and I definitely want to read that one. There's Some Kind of Fairy Tale by Graham Joyce, who's a British writer. And I think from what I remember hearing about this one is that it's about a family where the boy disappeared when he was very young and comes back years later claiming that he'd been to fairyland and had been living with the fairies, which sounds very, very strange. So I'm looking forward to reading that one too. A book that I have read is The Drowning Girl by Caitlin R. Kiernan, which is one of these really creepy horror things where the central character starts having these dreams about a strange woman that she's seen in a painting. And then she's driving along the road one night and she sees this girl standing naked by the side of the road. So, of course, she picks her up and takes her home, and dreadful things happen as a result. There's a book called Crandallin by Anna Tambor, who's an American writer who's been living in the Australian bush for many years. I have no idea what that's about, but I've read some other of Anna's books, and they're really, really strange. So that one, again, sounds fun. And finally, there's Alif the Unseen by G. Willow Wilson. Wilson is an American writer, but she spent a lot of time living in the Middle East, Egypt, I think. So this is a sort of fantasy and cyberpunk story set in the Middle East, where the boy character is a computer whiz, but also there are all sorts of strange magical things going on as well. So I think five very interesting books there. Stephanie, do you know anything about any of them?
I haven't read any of them, sadly. The one I've heard most about is Alif the Unseen, and that's sort of on my mental to be read pile. I've been writing a lot this year, and I find when I'm writing, I can't read as much because it sort of, there isn't enough space in my head for my narrative and somebody else's. So I know very little. The Drowning Girl and Alif the Unseen have been on my own sort of mental checklist for some time. And they do all sound like a really interesting and quite eclectic range. The book I read earlier this year at a break from my own, a bit of a reward to myself actually, when I finally finished, was Karen Lord's second novel, The Best of All Possible Worlds, and I would like to recommend that. It's really interesting. It's quite different from her first novel, Redemption in Indigo. It is more, it has more of a science fictional setup, although when the book gets underway, there is actually a bit less of that. It's set in the immediate aftermath of a genocide, essentially, which has robbed one of the branches of humanity living out amongst the stars of their homeland. And they're being resettled. Those that survived because they were off planet are being resettled onto one of the other planets. And one of the things you learn is that there are, I think, four or five different sort of branches of humanity, each all working together and interrelating, but with their distinctive personalities. The ones who've just been pretty much wiped out and are now trying to pull together the remnants of their scattered culture remind one very much of Mr. Spock from Star Trek. They are very much the kind of cerebral, unemotional, very mentally potent kind of, you know, race in the galaxy. And the woman that this representative of this race is paired up with, who is a sort of a local scientist and council officer, essentially assigned as liaison to help them find the people they need to find and get settled, is very different. She's very sort of sparky and spunky and quite emotional. And so that's the setup. That's the framing of it. But after that, it becomes, again, it reminds me a lot of episodic television, because it's a series of chapters where this crew, this task force, these two characters and several others, sort of go around the planet, going into different communities and different cultures, some of which have been sort of cut off for a very long time, and ostensibly talking to the people there and trying to find connections with the Sidiri, this lost species, but essentially having adventures along the way. And so Karen's done something that I think works very well for a beach read, because you can simply read a chapter and close the book. It's a whole little arc in itself. The next chapter is the same, the next chapter is the same. And then as you go through the entire novel, it builds the arc of the two characters and their relationship. So I think it's clever in itself. And I think she's also done some really interesting things with the novel's form and the form of television as interpreted through a novel.
Yeah. One of the things about the book is that there's these Spock-like people, the Sidiri, they're actually there looking for wives. And Karen told me, she was on the show a few months back, she said that she got this idea from reading reports of the tsunami in Sri Lanka that took place a few years back.
Yeah.
And what happened there was a lot of the men who were fishermen, whatever, were out at sea. So they survived, and most of the women and children died. So you have this society that's had this terrible tragedy, and it's only men left. So they're out there looking for women, and they're not the most charming of chaps.
They're not. I mean, they're not the most charming of chaps at all. Although, as a writer, I'm intrigued by what she's done, because most of the story is told in the voice of Grace, the local scientist, who is very chatty and tells us very early on in the book that she has an annoying voice, and then goes on to prove it in some of the stories which are told from her perspective. And actually, when you pop out and you get the third person's perspective of the Sidiri, you know that they're less pleasant people, but they're actually much calmer to read. So that makes you question your own presumptions about personality as well. And it's I did read an interview, I think, with Karen, where she talked about that being part where she got the idea for that setup. It's interesting on a lot of levels. I mean, there's something about the idea of lots of men going out looking for wives that makes my feminist soul slightly bristle. But it is a very, very human situation to be in. And clearly their guide through this quest is not a woman with whom one would trifle. So it's not sexist in that sense, but it's very interesting both in what it does as a story and in how it looks at gender roles as well and at those relationships.
And Karen, of course, is from Barbados, folks. If we had her on the show, she'd definitely be talking cricket with me. However, just moving on a little bit, last time I was on 2 weeks ago, I was talking about The Last Banquet by Jonathan Grimwood, which I've now finished reading. That's definitely a nice, fast and comfortable read. And I learned some interesting things about the Republic of Corsica. Though this is set just before the French Revolution, and Corsica was actually a sort of semi-independent country. It was supposedly owned by Genoa. And then the Genoese, because they couldn't control the Corsicans, sold the country to France. And the hero of the book is sent to Corsica to negotiate with the local ruler to try and get them to agree to be part of the Kingdom of France. But they have this relatively democratic republic in Corsica. And apparently it was one of the first places in the world to give women the vote. New Zealand, I think, came up with that somewhere around the beginning of the 20th century. But here's Corsica in around 1780 or so, giving women the vote, which I was really impressed with. The other thing is that, as you may remember from 2 weeks ago, the central character is a bit of a foodie. He's always looking for new and interesting tastes. And apparently in Corsica, they make a cheese from breast milk. So, and there's a recipe for it in the book. So there you go. Meanwhile,
all the women back in the studio are crossing their arms across their chest.
They are, yes. Oh, I should just before we go mention that my own publishing company put out another book yesterday. My good friend Juliet McKenna, I've been reissuing her Tales of Anarin, which is an epic fantasy series spread over 5 books. Which is not really like the Game of Thrones, which you might have seen on television, because it's much more about ordinary people doing far more ordinary things. There are big magic and political things on in the background, but it's very much grounded in ordinary people. So The Gambler's Fortune is the 3rd book in the series, and the other 2 books, which are The Thief's Gamble and The Swordsman's Oath, are available from wizardstowerbooks.com. There you go. Keeping my authors happy there. Anybody got any last recommendations before we get to the top of the hour?
Not really, other than me thinking the last time I read Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee and talking about beach reading or holiday reading just brought back some very pleasant memories of a beautiful Cretan beach with a cold beer to hand. So the book, yes, I'd recommend, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. In, I think,